Welcome to the Mandela Rhodes Foundation podcast. Under the auspices of our founding patron, Nelson Mandela's dream to build exceptional leadership capacity in Africa, we invite listeners to journey together with us as they hear intimate, behind-the-scenes stories that helped shape the journeys of remarkable African leaders and people on the rise. The Mandela Rhodes Foundation podcast is a platform for authentic and personal narratives of what it truly takes to rise to leadership with a uniquely African lens across a range of topics.
Shinaz, really welcome. It's so fantastic to be in conversation with you. I always find my conversations with you very inspiring and thought-provoking, and the invitation is really to continue to do that. And hopefully the people listening in can get a little bit of insight and thoughts around what it actually takes to be in leadership. So maybe I want to kick off by posing a question to you. You're a South African-born physician. You are in the pharmaceutical industry as an executive and a Rhodes Scholar. But if you were to really think deeply and reflect about how you describe yourself, how would you say, like, who's Shinaz and what's helped shape your early sense of purpose?
Thank you, Judy. And I'd say that it's really an honor and a privilege to be with you. I have to recall a celebratory dinner in 2004 on the eve of launching the foundation, at which our fearless patron, Nelson Mandela, was there, and he was radiating with excitement and joy. And I remember him asking us to join him to support the foundation in any way possible. You know, he had a clear vision for what this would be for African leaders, building and sustaining prosperity for everyone. So I'm deeply appreciative for the opportunity to fulfill a pledge and to be with you. So thank you for the invitation. On the question of, you know, what is it that's informed kind of who I am? I think, you know, I started out as a warrior, as that 15-year-old girl with a strong sense of justice under apartheid, putting ourselves on the line because it was the right thing to do and for the sake of our future and our freedom. So for 5 years, you know, during high school, that's all we knew. We protested, we were tear gassed, we were shot at. We would come back the next day and do it all over again. And we did it because we had little to lose. And the idealism of our youth and the shining example of Madiba. And so no matter what we had to sacrifice, it paled in comparison to what he was sacrificing. And he was our iconic leader. So my roots have fundamentally informed my core values around justice and integrity and leadership courage. And I have to admit, Judy, sometimes I feel like a little bit of a code switcher, because now, of course, I'm in the US, I'm in Silicon Valley, I'm in these high-powered environments, and we have conversations about speaking up and leadership courage in the corporate context. And I have to smile inside because my version of that is so extreme. When you have to stand up for your ideals facing the barrel of a gun as a kid, that's the definition of courage. You know, watinta bafazi, that's what it is. So my roots have been absolutely essential to shaping my sense of purpose. And I carry that with me wherever I go.
That's very powerful. So you grew up in the Cape Flats, right? A community in the Western Cape in South Africa that was very much shaped by low socioeconomic conditions and limited access to health. So I'm quite curious then, as you reflect on your sense of activism, you know, when did you first become aware of the societal inequalities, and particularly in health, given the space that you're in? And did that influence your decision to actually go into medicine?
Absolutely. Some of my earliest memories are, in fact, of being slumped on crowded benches in Red Cross Children's Hospital, waiting to see a doctor along with hundreds of other kids. You know, we'd say snot en trana everywhere, you know, because everybody was ravaged with infectious diseases. And I think by about the age of 10, I'd had them all, you know, measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, you name it. And so I recall that very vividly. And then in high school, we'd go into the townships, you know, with mobile soup kitchens and try to provide some care and comfort to communities in Googs, in Khayelitsha. And, you know, kids would line up in bare feet in muddy water for that cup of soup. And it was very real. And I honestly felt even back then, Judy, that we were putting a Band-Aid on a blister the size of Table Mountain. The inequalities in healthcare were so obvious for everyone to see. And we're talking about the basics, you know, clean water, electricity, food. It absolutely influenced my decision to go into medicine. And I think even then, it was really about how do you scale for impact in a way that could transform the realities of not just one patient, but entire communities.
And so do you think that lived experience as a young person sort of informed some of your activism and the way in which you think about justice today? Because, I mean, of course, we know some of your family members were, you know, involved in the anti-apartheid movement. So I'm curious about how you link that experience that you're sharing with us now to also the grounding that you might have received from your family. You know, tell us a little bit more about that, because I think that seems like it might have been an important part of shaping, you know, who you are now.
Definitely. My parents grew up in Pretoria, and, you know, they tell the stories of being spat at on the streets, you know, and the relentless harassing and bullying. And when they moved to Cape Town for a while, we lived in District 6. And then, of course, the Group Areas Act happened and homes were bulldozed. And there was a lot of retribution. So in their era, you know, I'd say the retribution from the nationalist government was cruel and unrelenting. This is, you know, the 70s. And then I went to school and my activism was awakened in the 80s. You know, my cousins in Johannesburg were hardcore activists and getting arrested. And I was following suit. There was just so much injustice around us. You know the drill. We've all had heard these stories, the whites only signs, the dogs, you know, put on kids, the tear gassing, the rubber bullets. And we could always look over the fence to see what was happening in the townships and how much worse off people were. And it provided perspective and an intuitive sense about, you know, how important it was for us to unite in the struggle, you know, from the stories of our elders and our parents to our own experience. It just became, you know, imperative. It was kind of obvious, you know, the regime was hell-bent on dividing us and we had to present a united struggle. And as kids, I have to say, we were kind of, our conviction blinded us to the risks we were taking. But at the same time, momentum was on our side, because by the time I graduated from high school, this was 1989, and it was pretty clear that Madiba was going to be released. And I was there on that day at Cape Town City Hall in February of 1990. And I remember it like yesterday when he gave his first address as a free man, and I'll never, ever forget it. So
what a moment, eh? Wow.
Yeah. Oh, my God, it was incredible. People hanging off the railings. And, you know, those seeds for fighting injustice were sown super early on. And, you know, it becomes, Judy, it becomes the framework through which you view the world and the lens. And and equally important, you just almost have an automatic response to figuring out, you know, what we need to do to address the inequality.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I mean, I guess then it's a nice place to sort of segue thinking about once you started to practice, right, in your field, you did your residency as a young doctor at the Ernest Oppenheimer Mining Hospital in Valcourt. And as you said, you know, early 1990s, Madiba's come out, but it's also at a very pivotal moment in the history of South Africa and the world, where HIV and AIDS was really becoming a prominent sort of reality. And you cared for many patients with HIV and AIDS at the heart of the epidemic. So I really would love you to share a little bit more about what that experience was like, especially right after the first democratic election. How did you feel? What was going on for you? And could you tell in that moment that this was a seminal moment in our history?
Yeah, well, I was so fortunate to be one of the first significant cohorts of, you know, so-called non-whites to study medicine at UCT. We had things starting to change, and it was a tremendous privilege and an even bigger privilege later on to go on to be a Rhodes Scholar. And I don't think that, you know, we, particularly the students who were given that opportunity, ever took that for granted, because for every one of us, there were thousands of others that were not given that opportunity. So I go to UCT, study medicine. By the way, it was incredibly hard because we had missed 5 years of basic biology, chemistry. I think I lived in perennial fear of failing every day. And of course, we were still active, because now it fell to the activists, to people who had been engaged in the struggle, to now begin to write the early healthcare constitution, to think about healthcare policy, to think about, you know, what sort of public health system we wanted to create for a better future. So in the midst of all of that, you know, you had to study the stuff you didn't know and try to be successful. So I would say it was a time of jubilation filled with hope for what the new South Africa would be. It was also a personal time of incredible stress, because trying to pass those exams and get through it was not easy. But we got through it, and then I went to Welcome, which, for those who aren't as familiar with, was, you know, it was the heartland, you know. It was where the most conservative Afrikaner community was, and frankly, still clinging to the vestiges of apartheid. So yes, it had ended on paper, but honestly, very little had practically changed in the mines. You had white mine managers that were still in positions of power and influence. You had large communities of black mine workers coming from, you know, Lesotho, Zimbabwe, Botswana, doing all the hard labor. And as you pointed out, to top it all off, the AIDS pandemic had hit, and South Africa and sub-Saharan Africa was hit like a tsunami. So picture this. You have single-sex hostels filled with young men who had come to work lonely, sleeping with the same sex worker. And if they happened to be HIV positive, the entire hostel would be infected. And then these young men would go home to their wives, and their families would be infected and completely wiped out. So the sheer, I would say, the socioeconomic injustice of the working conditions were appalling. And the violence at every level in the hostel, underground, the assault of AIDS, and so many people died on my watch. If there was ever any doubt in my mind that we needed a system-wide response to this than any individual could affect, that was a big part of the reason why I made that pivot more toward public health, more toward what can I do at a macro level. And, you know, to add insult to injury, the US had just developed the first HIV medication, AZT, which had become available in the US, but it was not available to us. And I was so incensed, enraged by this idea that something could be available and the purview of the privileged when all these patients were dying on my watch. So That was baptism by fire, and that was a big part of the reason why, you know, fast forward to Gilead and HIV treatment and prevention and how that journey unfolded. And I do wonder, even today, Judy, how much has changed for the communities in the mines? How much have their lives improved substantially? I can say that certainly on the question of access and HIV treatment, there have been huge strides made. But I very much ask myself the question, have we done as much as we could for those communities?
Yeah. No, I think very, very valid question, you know. So when I'm listening to you, I'm hearing is almost a thread that's starting to develop in your journey, you know, the activism when you were, you know, in your younger years, the influence of your family, and then actually going and working in Valcom. So I'm quite curious, maybe it might be helpful just to dig a little bit deeper around, you know, when you were working there in Valcom, it sounds like it was a very important formative process in your advocacy, specifically then around the HIV medicines, right? And I'm curious about what that process was like for you, looking at how, you know, patents were being developed around the world. Because as you said, right, the US already had developed, but it was not accessible. So tell us a little bit more about your experience in terms of the partnerships that were being developed around Indian generic companies, mm-hmm. you know, and then, you know, Gilead's HIV medicines then becoming available to South Africa, right? And I'm imagining that must have required some very, like, challenging, courageous conversations, you know, around conventional patent norms, as well as how we partner across borders. So,
yeah,
you know, what was that work like for you on the ground? And what did it teach you about the reality of HIV, AIDS, and the fight for that and access on the continent at that time?
Excellent questions. So, you know, at Oxford, I pivoted and I did development studies followed by business school. And I discovered and became very intrigued with biotech and specifically a company called Gilead in the San Francisco Bay Area that was developing what seemed like the most effective treatments for HIV at the time. And I immediately thought of Valcom and the miners. And my path to Gilead, ironically, was through Wall Street, which also provided, and it had everything to do with a visa, an H-1B visa. And, you know, that perspective on finance and capital markets and, you know, the axis of power and capital formation and capital allocation was incredibly helpful experience as I stepped into Gilead. Gilead was trying to develop a global access program, but really grappling with the business model for how do you balance these two seemingly competing priorities of, you know, driving access on the one hand in the developing world, and at the same time protecting your commercial markets. And that job really fell to a group of us. I was in business development at the time to think it through. And in the end, we just decided these two things cannot, in a sense, coexist. You either need to be committed to the goal of access, and the best you can do in your commercial markets is try to protect those markets. In other words, think about a carrots and sticks way to do deals for access that don't make money at all because they're about access. But at the same time, there's a risk mitigation component to those to allow your commercial markets to prosper. And that's what we did. So I flew to India, and it was a singular blessing to do that and negotiate these deals with Indian generic companies, where we essentially just gave away our tech transfer and manufacturing expertise to these Indian companies for free. But we did it in an interesting way. First of all, we gave the same deal to every company. We said, this is a take it or leave it. You're getting our manufacturing for free. It's cutting 10 years off of your prospects to reverse engineer these drugs. But everybody has the same deal. And the goal is you should all compete with each other to drive down the prices of these drugs as low as humanly possible to facilitate the goal of access. So that was the incentive, which was everybody getting the same deal, drive down the price. On the other hand, we said, if we see one of these pills in our commercial markets, that's it, we terminate the deal. So there was an incentive to drive down the price, create a healthy competitive dynamic. There was also a disincentive that if anybody tried to import these cheap pills into commercial markets, that that would immediately terminate the deal. And then we did one other thing. We said, and if you abide by the spirit of these agreements and show yourself to be a good partner, we will give you some of our commercial business. We will give you the opportunity to manufacture for markets that are of high interest, that are high profit-driven markets. And it worked great. And it also worked great because the U.S. government at the time provided the funding to African governments, so it even took away the need to pay anything at all. And so PEPFAR was introduced. And so the confluence of all of these dynamics meant that we went from 30,000 patients on treatment out of about 29 million that were infected to 30 million patients 10 years wow. later having access to treatment. And this is an example, Judy, of how these partnerships across borders can fundamentally transform the world. Honestly, of all the deals I've done, this is the one I'm most proud of. And it's hard to think about matching that kind of impact.
Look, listening to you, I've got goosebumps, you know, because it's really speaking to the, it was a systems approach, you know,
yep.
the fact that you were able to say, we want to give you these drugs and you must compete to actually drive the prices down. A lot of people wouldn't approach things in that way. And I think that speaks to that sense of courage, vision, and a deep desire to actually see real societal impact. So, I mean, I'm glad to hear you say that was a very seminal experience for you, because I think that's part of what I reflect on when I look at the world today. You know, we're losing that ability to say, how do we think about societal impact, but also at the same time, allow people to also be commercially ambitious, but there are certain, you know, initial foundations that need to be put in place. So it's interesting you're talking about the U.S. government at the time and the sort of conditions that they created. We are mm-hmm. in 2025 now, which is a very different time. And the U.S. executive order to freeze foreign aid resulted in cutting numerous health programs all over the world, including South Africa. What lessons did you take from, you know, that sort of particular moment in time about the fragility of, you know, health progress when it is so tightly tied to shifting political tides and investment priorities?
So, Judy, the U.S. democracy is being stress tested now like never before. I would say that institutions are holding, but norms and trust are under tremendous strain. You know, the result of that are large cuts to international programs like PEPFAR, like USAID, and a shift to a new reality, which is really about isolationist policies that are ultimately going to affect everyone. I think it is deeply disappointing that the shifting tide in the U.S. has turned against these sorts of policies that have been aimed at improving the quality of life for the world's most marginalized. And it seems that we're living in a time where people don't care about the world's marginalized. So what do we do about it? I think, first of all, we should endeavor to try to cut through what is rhetoric versus what is real. Much of what we're seeing play out, particularly in the U.S. right now, is about what's happening in the court of public opinion.
Mm.
I've been to Washington, D.C. several times to meet with Republican lawmakers and to talk about the importance of not eroding our leading edge in innovation in sectors like biotech and what happens what the downstream consequences, not just to Americans, but to patients around the world, are if that happens. And behind closed doors, people agree with us. They see the damage which is being done. So I think, difficult as it may be, because social media is so pervasive, it's important to try and think about where are the opportunities to negotiate and find common ground.
Which is very much the sort of Madiba way, right? What's the third way in all of this? Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah. It's about finding the opportunities to build alignment, because there are always areas where common narratives can be found. And this is what we need to get back to, which is building the trust about things that we care about mutually. And secondly, I think as a practical matter, it just heightens the need for countries, South Africa and elsewhere, to become self-reliant and to build that capacity from within. I know that's much easier said than done. But for example, we have an outstanding generic drug manufacturing capability in South Africa with companies like Aspen and others that frankly can more than fulfill the needs of the entire country and continent. So this is creating an opportunity for others, you know, whether it be in private sector or elsewhere, to step up and fill the void. You know, this is not something that's going to change itself. The reality of our world right now is that we must all change, and in a way, we must all become activists for the greater good. That's what the world is demanding from us.
I love that. So when I hear you saying that, there's then a question about what role you think African scientists and medical leaders can play in shaping global health innovation, and perhaps what is the barrier standing in the way? Is it an internal barrier as Africans that we don't believe we have the capabilities that you speak about? Or are there other sort of systemic barriers that are preventing us from really stepping into playing a leadership role in global health innovation?
A critical role that we play and that we have to play is in advocacy. So, you know, in continuing to advocate on behalf of not just South Africans, the region, I think developing countries around the world, is this idea of, you know, partnership, gaining access to treatments which can help expedite, you know, access for the entire. So the question of advocacy in forums like World Health, in forums, you know, that I know South Africa has terrific representation in. You know, I'd say at Gilead, we partnered extensively with investigators throughout South Africa to enable the approval of our HIV meds. Many of the clinical trials were in fact done in South Africa. And the whole concept of PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, happened because of understanding the unmet needs in South Africa, whether it was with sex workers or with women in the rural areas or with disenfranchised communities where that power differential did not allow people to take HIV medications. And I would say this is a massive success story, because recently we had the approval of a twice yearly injectable PrEP treatment. And this is another breakthrough in the fight against HIV. All you need to do is take one injection twice a year. So our capacity in Africa, in South Africa, is very strong in areas such as infectious diseases, you know, HIV, TB, malaria, and manufacturing. But it's not so strong in other areas. You know, I think the biotech ecosystem, for example, doesn't really exist. And a big part of that, as you alluded to, is because the funding environment, the venture capital, the seed funding, the angel funding, is something which isn't there to support innovation in the way that you need to in order for companies to really scale, you know, especially if you're pre-proof of concept. But this is an excellent place for MRF scholars and the Arnott Prize and other, you know, social impact funding to come in to continue to advance and build the ecosystem. It's also the opportunity for cross-border partnerships, you know, for more sophisticated conversations about how do we access capital? How do we leverage scale economies? How can we build businesses that are of interest, not just locally and regionally, but also internationally, you know, to enable the sustainability and viability long term? I mean, this is where people like me come in. You know, how do you leverage that global network of connections and access to fundraise, to pressure test business plans, to find those intersections in the Venn diagram that will heighten the probability of success, ultimately.
Okay, so I'm gonna ask you something, and please feel free to, you know, to speak as honestly as you're able to. But there's sort of two things you spoke about, which I think are quite crucial. The one is, it was something you mentioned around the cultural shift required for people to actually take the meds. And you also spoke about political leadership and the importance of that. I mean, we in South Africa sat with the very real reality where the president of South Africa had views around HIV/AIDS that a lot of scientists found almost, you know, they were confused. Like, how can the president have this, these perspectives when it is someone who is seen as, you know, smart and, you know, economist and worldly and built relationships across the world, you know? So I'm curious about, around the question of leadership, what is, in your views, the process of leadership development that is necessary to help people who step into leadership positions where they might be faced with situations like an HIV epidemic, or, you know, in the later years we had COVID, you know, to be prepared enough to grapple with their own cultural views or heritage perspectives, but then still have to be listening to multiple perspectives around what scientists are saying around, you know, epidemics that evolve. Because I think I was quite curious hearing you speak about the cultural shifts. And in South Africa, we did struggle a little bit, you know, having a president who had the views that they had at the time.
Of course. I think it's extremely important to be able to speak truth to power, but to do it in a way that people will listen. And this is where the medium is the message. I think if we come into situations saying, creating this value judgment around knowledge, i.e. we have the answers and you don't, and therefore this is the way it should be, of course that's going to be met with resistance. You know, I saw this in Welkom, where patients who had HIV would see the local doctor and go get the mutti, you know, and take it. And, you know, sometimes it was a fantastic concoction of stuff and it was harmful. But that was so deeply ingrained in the culture and the value system around beliefs about what would help and make their lives better. And, you know, what this requires is a culturally sensitive conversation about, you know, about the facts, for one, a huge educational component around what is going on. You have a virus, the virus is fatal if you don't address it, and here's how you can do it. And also, I must say, an openness to saying you can try other things, but let's explain and let's unpack, you know, what the potential consequences of doing that are. And it's coming to the conversation in a way that meets people where they are. And that's so, so important. And then I think you just need, at a system-wide level, the kinds of policies that are put in place to protect the vulnerable, to protect folks like migrant laborers who haven't had a primary school education. And so trying to explain the concept of a fatal virus to someone who doesn't understand what a virus is through no fault of their own. But this is where the doctors come in, the local healers. We come together in a way to say this is in the best interest of our population. And by the way, it's not just about curing the disease. It's about enabling communities to be productive and constructive. And I think about what would have happened if we had not found a treatment for HIV. We would have 8 million people in South Africa being economically unproductive, being a huge burden on the healthcare system, providing, you know, unable to provide for their families and their communities. So I think taking that conversation away from you did something and therefore this is now your problem to, like, let's help you understand how you can live a productive, constructive life and be an active member of your community because of what this treatment enables. And honestly, we did not have those kinds of conversations. And what we had was a lot of ping pong, political ping pong, you know, people trying to score points around a very serious issue, whether that was HIV. I saw some of it under COVID as well. And ultimately, I would say that was not in the best interests of our people. And as leaders, I would say it's essential, it's incumbent on us to take the conversation out of that realm and to take it higher. Let's talk about what really makes a difference and how this is going to change your life in ways that are going to be so constructive.
I love that. It's almost, when I listen to you talking now, it's that concept of Ubuntu, right? I am because we are, right? And I love the idea that if we were able to engage with the church leaders, the Sangomas, and all the people that they trust, because it's essentially around an issue of trust and leadership, right? And how do we, when we think about policies and systemic changes, engage with, as you said, where people are at and walk the journey with them in actually understanding that this treatment is going to help you live more productive. But then I guess maybe in a way it speaks to shame and what a big role that plays in our communities and cultures in Africa of, I've got this disease, which means I'm shunned and I'm kicked out of the community, you know? So there's a lot of mindset elements that I'm hearing you speak about.
And we have made a lot of progress. People now are on treatment, and I think particularly women can be empowered, you know, to take a pill every day when you brush your teeth, to take an injection twice a week. You don't even, you know, you don't even have to disclose this. It's within your power to do this for yourself. And I love the fact that particularly this next generation is so in tune with these issues of choice, of power, of advocacy, of being able to control and self-direct decisions around healthcare, reproductive health, you know, prosperity, and a life that is enabled because you are in fact healthy.
So this leads us nicely to a question that I wanted to ask you about. You know, now you're the CEO of Recode Therapeutics and, you know, a clinical stage genetic medicines company that's based in Silicon Valley. What is the company actually trying to do in the healthcare space and how it differs from its competitors?
Of course. So what we're trying to do is truly novel and has not been done before. if you think about mRNA, what is mRNA? It's really the code that gives your cells instructions to do something. You know, in the context of COVID, for those of us that got a COVID vaccine, it contains an mRNA that is encapsulated in a lipid nanoparticle, because mRNA is pretty unstable. And so you have to, it's the tiny protective bubble that shields the mRNA, and you can think of the mRNA going to cells in this delivery truck encapsulation and delivering the code to your cells, the instructions, once it gets inside your cell, to train your immune system to recognize a piece of the virus so that it can fight the infection for the future. So at ReCode, we're building on all of that great knowledge and science around the vaccines, and we're creating novel LNPs, so really novel delivery vehicles that are super specific. So they can deliver mRNA not just to specific tissues and organs like the lung, but to specific cells within the lung. And that's really important for some genetic diseases like cystic fibrosis, for example, where these patients have a genetic mutation. They don't make a protein called the CFTR protein. And when they don't make that protein, their lungs are filled with mucus. They develop recurrent infections. Many of the cystic fibrosis patients who don't have a treatment today die as very young adults. So our lung LNP goes directly to the cell in the lung that makes the CFTR protein and provides that code. And if you think about the possibilities, a brain LNP can go to specific cells in the brain like microglia that are important to neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease. So in this way, we can combine the right genetic payload with the right delivery vehicle and go very specifically to the right cell type that we need to reprogram. And so this is really pioneering the field of targeted precision genetic medicines.
Mm. Hey, it's giving future, it's giving futuristic, you know? And I guess it's in a sense, it's, you know, you're working in the field of disruptive innovation, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm curious about how you're thinking about what role AI will play in shaping innovation in the life sciences sector and potentially maybe in other areas of healthcare, where we've got this just enormous amount of capabilities to gather data, research information, and then be able to pinpoint in the way that you've spoken about clinical trials that really get to the source of things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think AI has the ability to revolutionize healthcare in every context. You know, in our world, in biotech, AI can help with compressing timelines, with, you know, stratifying patients for trials, trying to use predictive capabilities to see what's the right inclusion and exclusion criteria. You know, then you have the convergence of AI with things like genomics, you know, and tools that we now have to understand biology and patient data in ways that were not possible before. So we can see the possibility of designing treatments virtually to a point and with minimal human sweat equity, and saving the human sweat equity for when it really counts, like when you have to do those trials and utilize patients and get into, you know, proof of concept. And so I'm super excited about the possibilities there, as well as on the service and delivery part of the spectrum, the ability to democratize healthcare and healthcare access in the developing world in a way that wasn't possible before. So if you have one radiologist who now needs to read your X-ray, you can use AI, which is about 90% and in some cases even more effective than what a radiologist would be at reading those X-rays, at reading those pathology results. And so now we can scale healthcare in clinics. We can improve access. If you have an internet connection and you have a scan or an X-ray, it can be sent to an AI that will be the first point of call now, potentially. And similarly, for common diseases, there's no reason why you couldn't speak to a machine and an AI portal. So I think it's going to totally change the way we innovate and care for patients. And of course, being in the drug discovery space, I'm excited about how this will accelerate new treatments in a way that is faster, more efficient, and more cost-effective.
Mm. You know, you're someone who comes from the Cape Flats, a woman of color, and I can imagine, you know, it really is, it's, at least from where I sit, a deeply inspiring and significant sort of journey that you've traveled, you know. It's almost like from the Cape Flats to Silicon Valley, you know. So how do you reflect on your identity and your background, where you are now, and how that's influenced the leadership ethos that you've embodied in these global boardrooms?
Yeah, look, courage doesn't have a gender or a color. You know, I think experiencing adversity early on was a gift because you get the perspective early on. And, you know, we can all relate to this. I'd be hard-pressed to find a single South African or an African that cannot relate to some experience with adversity. And my experience was by no means the worst. There are so many others that have experienced far worse. I think what it does is when you see it and you feel it and you face it, it never really leaves you. And so then the question becomes, what do you do with it? And that is a choice. The choice I made was to reflect on the learnings I gained and to use it to make me a better person and a better leader, because, you know, I always say, if it's not hurting, it's not working, which means that deep adversity has allowed me to develop deep empathy. And it's real. You know, I feel that I can intuitively relate to others who have experienced struggles with empathy and with the eyes of experience. And so now you fast forward to having to operate in different kinds of environments, environments where there are sophisticated dynamics, you know, around power and power imbalances. And, you know, under apartheid, I learned how to speak truth to power in a way that they would hear it ultimately. And now we think about how to use those same skills in many different contexts. And truthfully, it's not that different, because it comes down to understanding the situational context, being super mindful of the dynamics in the room, whether that's the boardroom, whether that's the management team, whether it's trying to really meet people where they are, walk in their shoes, and then use the opportunity to build alignment. What we're losing is alignment to a mission that we can get behind. In my case, you know, advancing science, improving healthcare for all, many people can get behind that. And I think that when you experience adversity, it's a wonderful teacher for building skills, for creating change, and for utilizing those learnings in many, many different contexts. It comes down to a choice, you know. It's up to us to decide how we use these teachings to build that consensus, to build the alignment in service of the better good.
Mm. No, I love that. And it's very powerful because it certainly resonates with, you know, my own journey and how I've tried to look at things. But I'm curious, especially because you're also a mom, how one navigates the balance between trying to make sure that your child doesn't go through certain hardships, mm-hmm. right, that the system had, but then also on the other side of the coin, not pampering them to a point where they are not building skills of, you know, resilience and understanding that the world is actually both beautiful and also tough. Because that's certainly something, as I look at my 6-year-old daughter now, where I'm trying to be more present in thinking about some of the ways in which I was raised that I don't want to raise her in, but also there's some benefits in some of the ways I was raised that I think helped build that resilience. So how have you grappled and managed that, especially with your children, you know, like being in the US?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And I think probably the number one challenge for parents with, you know, kids growing up in very protected environments, I think you choose the opportunities where they get the chance to fail forward, and you choose the opportunities where you support. And, you know, sometimes that can be an intentional choice. You know, for example, both of my kids play water polo and they get beaten up in the pool left and right. I mean, the scratches, the bruising, what you don't see that happens underwater. It's an excellent opportunity for Skopskita and Donner. You know, this is the place. I'm like, the goal is to win and you will get beaten up. And just because it's hard, it doesn't mean that you quit. It means that you try harder, you know? Sports is a fantastic way, particularly for young girls, I think, to get into teamwork, collaboration, competitive spirit, fighting for something, and you get to be a warrior on the sports field. And, you know, and it takes it away from a lot of the dynamics that start to happen when girls become teenagers and they have to buy into, you know, pop culture. And so I found that to be a very interesting place to just let my kids get beaten up. And yeah, it's been fantastic for them. And the lessons that come out of the sports field and teams and, you know, being a resilient leader when your team sucks. I mean, this is a great proxy for what life is about.
100%. Know? And learning to lose, right? And to lose gracefully.
How to be a gracious leader. Exactly. So that's a great example. And then I think exposure is the other thing we control as parents. You know, yes, you can go on holiday and stay at fancy hotels, but you can also sleep on the couch in your cousin's house and see the world through their eyes. You know, you can go to the rural areas and, you know, I mean, so the exposure is something we very much control as parents. And I think that we can be super intentional about that. And the last thing I'd say on the parenting front is, you know, never, never, ever, I tell my kids, don't ever take for granted the great privilege that you have been given. Because while your life is relatively free of adversity, all that means is that it's created a tremendous opportunity for you to make a difference to others. And that has to be the purpose that factors into your life at some level.
Very much.
So constantly reminding our children, who are by nature very self-focused, of their great fortune and their great privilege is something we have to do.
Yeah. Parenting has been a very interesting process of actually a coming home to myself as I heal my own inner child, as I reflect and appreciate what my mother has actually done to get me to this place and how incredible, despite those external circumstances, you know? So when you think about the question of home, I mean, you've lived and worked in many places. When you've been interviewed in several instances, you've reflected on taking trips back to South Africa as a South African born. So what does going back home mean for you now in a physical but also spiritual sense, right?
Yeah, it's coming back to my roots, you know, and the humility of where you start. And it's coming back to family and friendships. And a big part of it is having just the most unbelievable admiration for what people are doing, still doing, continuing to do in South Africa. You know, my teachers in the public high school I attended, who have been there for 20 or 30 years, who are now educating the next gen, my med school class and buddies who are as committed as ever to serving and caring for patients in the communities, in the townships, advancing the science and research. My cousin Shabir Mahdi is one of the best scientists in South Africa and the world. You know, I mean, he led the pandemic response, developed the AstraZeneca vaccine, and he's doing it, you know, at Barrow Gwynedd Hospital. And he's proud of that legacy of science and research. And so many of my friends from my graduating med school class who were just doing incredible things. So I come home and I feel incredibly humbled and proud, you know, of all of these. And then looking at MRF and what's been accomplished, the 700 or so scholars that are the future, who, you know, the honored prize and the ability to hear these phenomenal ideas, you know, with you in a few weeks about people who are trying to change the world and uplift communities. So my coming home to South Africa is always such a joy because it's the opportunity to have pride and respect and admiration for what our South African communities are continuing and leaders are continuing to accomplish. And then also to think about how can I support you? How can I support you in a tangible way? How can I use the connections, the access, the resources that I have to help you become even more productive? Mm-hmm. And this brings me back to that promise that Madiba asked us to make, you know, all those years ago. He's like, wherever you are, wherever you go, continue to find a way to make a difference. So it's all of that for me.
Ah, you're such a, you really are a brave heart. And when you were saying earlier about, you know, the courage and the warrior, it's, you know, for me, brave heart, Mel Gibson, I think, was the actor in that movie. Yeah. Back in the day, it's that balance between the warrior, but also the just genuine, kind humanity, you know, and I think you really mm-hmm. embody that so beautifully. So if we then think about, as you were saying, you know, what it might mean to, you know, help and give back to people, perhaps maybe for those listening who feel that responsibility to lead and serve beyond themselves, and maybe to those who are still finding their feet, what mm-hmm. advice would you give on aligning one's career with lasting purpose?
I was fortunate because, you know, I decided early on that making a difference was my purpose, and trying to figure out the exact context was something that I grappled with a bit. But, you know, when you're fighting apartheid, your values are established. You're like, yeah, justice, injustice, it's clear on what side of the fence I am. Great, game on. But, you know, I became a doctor to care for patients, but one-on-one. But then I realized, gosh, I can have such greater impact on many more by pivoting to public health. And so that was the next step, you know, into innovation and drug development. Because as an innovator, I bring hope to patients who don't have any. As an industry leader, I partner with others to address, you know, issues in public policy and human health that are pretty urgent. So it's about making a difference. And so I have always said it's really great to focus on establishing foundational skills, because when you have that, it can be leveraged to multiple contexts. When you have a core skills playbook, that creates the optionality to do many different things. And then you can build a platform and you can use your platform for the betterment of society. So my skills as a doctor built all this great firsthand experience about what it means to care for patients who have run out of options. And I could draw on it in industry to address the unmet patient needs, because I could say with credibility, I know what it felt to be there. My skills as a banker allowed me to become adept at deal making and strategy. When I was at a place at Gilead, we were trying to figure out these complex mechanisms for scaling access. And my skills as a project team leader were essential to becoming an effective CEO. So it doesn't always have to be about what is the end game. There are so many ways to leverage foundational skills. And I think what's important is that you maintain that thirst for learning and the curiosity to build skills that are going to be the foundation later for your ability to leverage and, you know, amplify impact.
Oh, I love it. And, you know, we speak to our students on this because I think sometimes we are raised in systems that are quite linear. You study this, you do that, the next step is that. But I mean, especially in this ever-changing world that we sort of spoke to earlier, it is really about doing the hard work. And I think sometimes I find a frustration in the younger generation where they have these ideas, which of course are brilliant and no one's ever thought about it ever before. And I should be at a director level in the first year in an organization. But I think it's exactly to your point. Getting your hands dirty on the ground and actually understanding the technicalities of these the industries that we're in, and then being able to harness the what one might perhaps call a toolbox. What's actually in my toolbox and how do I keep being open to relationships and connections where the different facets in my toolbox might actually coalesce into the next thing instead of thinking about climbing a ladder. I mean, I certainly was ambitious, but I don't think I say to myself, oh, I'm going to, my goal is to be a CEO. I just like, no, my goal is to, you know, I really enjoy coaching. I really enjoy leadership development. I'm really interested in systems and, you know, so everything sort of comes together, but you had to do the hard graft, you know?
Yeah, totally, Judy. And what you said about chasing titles, that's not a good strategy in my view, because it truly limits your ability to build these skills. And it's a pathway killer, you know, and I'm not suggesting at all that people not negotiate, you know, good compensation and opportunities for development. But there have been several times where I took a title demotion because a job gave me the opportunity to learn so much more and access to bigger projects and better decision makers and the ability to align with leaders who were going to support me. And really, you know, it felt like a little bit of a setback at the time, maybe momentarily, but in terms of the acceleration to my trajectory later on, it was pretty profound.
Exactly. And so sitting here as fellow CEOs, the question that always comes to mind is how do you maintain balance and well-being amid these very high stakes demands of leadership?
Well, this is a question, Judy, that you and I will spend our lifetimes trying to find an answer to. As women in particular, I think we believe that we must somehow be superheroes, when we really should be focused on finding our superpower.
Mm.
And I say, I'm getting better at saying no to things that don't move the needle, right? And saying yes to things that align to our strengths. Because when you do that, you can align with people that have shared values and, you know, the power and the access to be able to fast track opportunities. And, you know, learning how to engage with decision makers, with power constructively, with accelerating outcomes, with fast tracking, with efficiency. I think this helps maintain the balance and well-being that we all strive for. Hmm. And, you know, my superpower, I think, is finding global alliances and driving them to execution and seeing how they can change the world. And I'm going to find opportunities that are in the sweet spot of my superpower to continue to amplify the impact I can have.
And for fun, come on, what do you do for fun when you're not trying to change the world? We see you, your auntie, yeah, superwoman, you know. What do you do for fun? What are the cool things you get to do, you know, for fun?
one of the reasons I live in California is because it's a great second best to Cape Town. San Francisco is a great second best. I find that I can truly recharge in nature. And we are blessed to be surrounded by so much of it. So I swim, I bike, I run, I hike. I sign up for the occasional triathlon. You know, I suck at all three, get my butt kicked, and it's nice and humbling. But, you know, I'm going to be a forever beginner runner, and that's okay.
I love that. Nah, that's beautiful. I really love that. So, Shanaz, as we wrap up, you've spoken about the importance of values and legacy. And so I'm curious, what does legacy mean for you? And how do you sort of think about the legacy that you'd like to shape? So whether that's for Recode, for patients, for the industry, or for the world?
Yeah. The world can feel overwhelming and divisive right now. You know, it's easy to feel lost and indifferent and to let the focus and the hope, you know, slip away and the hope fade. And I would say don't. I think of this as a moment of opportunity, because this is when a great leader can rise like a phoenix from the ashes and show the way. Because leadership is not only about what happens in the best of times, quite the contrary. It's about what happens sometimes in the worst of times. And I see my job as a leader as not losing hope, as inspiring others and, you know, showing the way, the way of the future, the possibility. Because the measure of a leader is not in comfort, but it's in showing that resilience when the world seems to be pushing the hardest. Mm. So back to your point about Ubuntu, I mean, legacy to me is the Ubuntu, or the humanity that will endure. And it's the recognition that what unites us is more powerful than what divides us. So at Recode, we are focused on finding treatments for patients who have none. From a technical point of view, what we're doing is incredibly hard and challenging. It's capital intensive. We've needed to raise more than $400 million just to get the opportunity to test it in the clinic. And if it works, we'll have a breakthrough for patients. And that's why we're seeing it through. And this is the legacy I'm focused on at Recode. But as an industry, biotech is under fire on all fronts. But the science and the tools to understand science have never been stronger. So it's a paradox that at our brightest scientific moment, we're colliding with the harshest political and financial pressure. And it falls to us as leaders to articulate to the powers that be, to the U.S. administration, why it matters that this industry remain intact and what are the consequences if not. So I am going to continue to be a truth seeker and a truth speaker. And I recall that time in 1995, you know, when we in South Africa, we were at our Invictus moment. We were united and Madiba was at the height of his superpower. And we were a shining example for the world. And we can be there again. And I'm so looking forward to hearing about this next gen and how they're going to get there for the betterment of all Africans. And I would say, there has never been a better time for a great leader to emerge. I am in the practice of regularly summoning my inner Mandela when things are hard.
That's right.
And saying to myself, I don't lose here because I win or learn, his very famous quote. And I'm doing my part, you know, to articulate and drive that vision that unites us in purpose, using the best in all of us for the betterment of all of us, to lift our humanity higher. We have to reach higher. We must rediscover our shared humanity and reach higher.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Shanaz, Thank you so much for such a rich conversation. And just being so generous in your sharing. Really, you're someone who I certainly look up to. And I think many of our listeners will feel very inspired learning about your journey, coming from the Cape Flats, the process of your experiences working in the hospital in Welkom, and then really being at the forefront of how we think about patents, and then moving to that global, you know, space. But importantly, showing us that humanity, which I think Madiba really stood for. So thank you so much for making time to be in this conversation with us.
Thank you for listening to the Mandela Rhodes Foundation podcast. To learn more about the Mandela Rhodes Foundation, visit our website at www.mandelarhodes.org. Follow us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram for more updates. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast on your platform of choice to be notified of new episodes. This is a Volume Podcast production.